This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we speak with President Manuel Zelaya of Honduras on the Nicaraguan side of the border as he talks about the current situation in his country and what he is demanding from the international community. Also, an update on Leonard Peltier from his lawyer and from American Indian Movement leader Bill Means. And our special correspondent John Elmer speaks to us from the occupied West Bank on continued undermining of Palestinian justice and democracy by U.S. officials. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we're back with Tim Russo, who is standing with President Manuel Zelaya, the president, the duly constituted president of Honduras. Tim Russo, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, Dennis. I'm here just a couple meters from President Zelaya. We're on the Nicaraguan side of the border here at Las Manos. There's obviously lots of press here. We're surrounded by about 400 or 500 people, mainly people from the countryside that have walked as many as 8 hours to get here to greet Manuel Zelaya and to accompany him on whatever attempt that he might have to get back into to Honduras. I'm going to try and take the telephone close to him and ask him a question so you can have him live on the phone in San Francisco for a moment. Estamos vivos en San Francisco.
Bueno, nosotros agradecemos la presencia de todos ustedes. Usted viene de San Francisco.
We thank you, you're present.
San Francisco, ¿qué?
San Francisco, South Unidos.
California. Ah, bueno,
I had to hear bastante largo, glad to hear you're calling from California.
Hondureño en San Francisco, California. Yo tengo amigos ahí.
I have friends who are Honduran in San Francisco, California.
Por los emigrantes, que están defendiendo de los derechos de los emigrantes.
Appreciate
y aquí tenemos a
Immigrant Rights.
Vive TV y Alba TV, televisora pública de Venezuela. Bueno, gracias por venir.
Thank you to the Venezuelan TV people who are here with me now.
Can I ask you, President Zelaya?
Mire, yo he dado todas las treguas. He sido ampliamente tolerante, he tenido espera con la comunidad internacional, he apoyado todas las decisiones que ha tomado la comunidad internacional, lo que dijo Naciones Unidas, lo que dijo la OEA, lo que dijo la secretaria Clinton,
Clinton
con Oscar Arias, y apoyé inclusive los 15 puntos que propuso Arias. Sin embargo, los golpistas siguen reprimiendo al pueblo.
Coup people continue to repress the people. They keep violating the human rights. They keep appropriating themselves of what belongs to the Hondurans. They have betrayed the power of the state.
Una madrugada de mi casa.
They came
nunca
in the early morning in my house.
Nunca me pusieron un juicio.
They didn't
nunca
me take me to trial.
Ninguna acusación.
They didn't accuse
embargo,
me formally, judicially.
Han inventado acusaciones
they have
contra
invented
mí, contra ministro,
charges
contra
against me.
Esta gente tiene
these
que
people
evidencia ante el mundo
have
para que el mundo
to put evidence before
ellos.
The world so
no
that the world will respond to it. But they have never done this.
Forma. Los golpes de Estado
the
deben quedar eliminados
coups
de la
have to be eliminated.
President Zelaya, can I ask you? No one is interested in the causes.
Y promueven soluciones a los problemas.
The causes have to be resolved. We have to look for solutions to the causes of problems.
Cada 10 ciudadanos, 8 viven en niveles de pobreza. 3 viven en pobreza extrema.
With every 10 Hondurans, 8 live in poverty and 3 live in extreme poverty.
Ha estado en estas condiciones, creo que
with the people who are living in these conditions, they deserve something better.
Los cambios tienen que ver
and they deserve a change.
Con la forma
and those changes have to do with
establishing
a system of power. And I believe that those who are in privilege as a result of this situation, this is the only way to resolve this is to have citizen participation.
And
I have presented this as a proposal, and they, as soon as I did, they started to conspire against me. I wanted a agrarian reform. I wanted rights for the campesinos, for social programs. I was opening up the process to this.
I
declared my government as center-left. All of this contributed to the fact that the oligarchy would oppose me and my programs.
Including
Otto Reich and Carmona and others who helped the coup makers conspire against me. They thought it was easy. They thought it would be very easy to get rid of me, like we were in the 60s.
But the
people have 27 days in the streets and demanding that our president return. The people are not going to be permitted to be humiliated in this way. The people do not accept coups d'etat in these days. So this is something that has taken us backwards. The revolution, which is peaceful, is what it really needs to triumph. So these people provoked the coup d'etat. They said that we were doing a poll, and which was illegal, but this is what they used as an excuse to have a coup against me. But what it is true fear to change, true fear to citizen participation in the governmental process. These are the illegitimate people who have appropriated themselves of the riches of our nation. And they are mistaken. This coup shows that they are incapable. They are not able to move forward, and we are going to move forward. What other measures should be taken against the coup? The monarchy of politics of those in power in Honduras need to be reversed. I participate in one of those powers, the Liberal Party, and now we need to look for other paths. We were involved in looking and doing a straw poll with the social sectors, with the popular movement, with the people in the streets, with the unions, with the workers, with the... And so I was doing this not with those who are in the upper echelons of power. We were trying to develop a process in favor of the people. And so those in the power structures, the powers that be, were opposed to this.
We're hearing Manuel Zelaya from a car on the border of Las Manos between Nicaragua and Honduras. I stepped away for a moment and give him a chance to answer a couple of other questions from other journalists that are here with us at the border. But I believe you were translating simultaneously there. In general, what he was saying was a response to a very good question as to what provoked the coup d'etat here in Honduras. And he was explaining in his words that it was giving the population an opportunity to participate in making their own decisions about the politics of the country.
Thank you. We got a beautiful Tim Russo. We got a beautiful translation from Andres here in the studio, Andres Tomas Cantariz, who is working with Democracy Now! And other organizations in the studio translating. Tim, say something more about the scene. Are you on the Honduran side or the Nicaraguan side? Is he planning to go back?
We're right now on the Nicaraguan side of the border. We're about 10 meters from the Honduran side of the border, but indeed we are on the Nicaraguan side of the border. What he's told us is that the day has not ended. Although we're at sunset here at 6:15, the sun is going down, it's starting to get a little bit dark, but he said that the day has not ended and anything is possible. But it looks like most probably he's going to head back to Estelí in Nicaragua, in the Ocotal region, and try and regroup, look at possibilities and strategies. They say that part of his reasoning about not saying whether or not he'll go back into Honduras or when or where is to keep things confused as far as the military and whatnot. A moment ago, he spoke to us
about the military. He said he has had contact with different military leaders. I believe you probably have this information already, but the lieutenant colonel with whom he spoke with personally on the border that let him cross the border into Honduras was subsequently arrested by higher authority here under General Romeo Vasquez's orders from Tegucigalpa. Right now, actually, the car that Manuel Zelaya is in has just turned its motor on. It looks like he might be about to head away from the border. They're shutting the windows and the doors of the vehicle. Security cordon is being set up around him. People are going to accompany him at least a little further into the Nicaraguan part of the border.
Tim, can you get close to him again for a question?
No, he's now shut the window of the vehicle, and the vehicle is turned on. It looks like they may be pulling out any second. So it's impossible at this point to get back into the vehicle.
All right, Tim, let me...
He might not be seeing anything. He seems to be having a sandwich.
He seems to be having a sandwich. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking with Tim Russo, who's at the border between Nicaragua and Honduras on the Nicaraguan side. You were just listening to a translation of a sort of spontaneous press conference here broadcast live on Flashpoints. What I wanted to ask the president, we didn't get a chance, is to respond to what Hillary Clinton said earlier today. She said that Zelaya's attempt to go back into Honduras was, quote, reckless, and I quote her, "We have consistently urged all parties to avoid any provocative action that could lead to violence," she said. Did he respond to this kind of response from the State Department?
He didn't respond to that particular question. Moments before I received a call from Flashpoint, I had another opportunity to speak with him, and I asked him what message he would send to the United States, and his message at that point was that in order for Barack Obama to win the presidency, that was because of mass democratic participation by the people, and that the people in America had chosen to create change in the United States. His message was that here in Latin America, people again are changing and asking for change, demanding change, and they want to be able to participate in political decision. He did not respond to a question about comments by Hillary Clinton. At this point, if that was a statement she made earlier today, it's highly unlikely that he's even received that information as of yet, because he's been at the border most of the day, and I'm not sure what sort of diplomatic contact they have outside of Nicaragua at this point.
And what about there are reports coming out of Washington that, in fact, he was going to return to Washington on Tuesday. Is there any way to confirm that, or is that just Washington talk?
It sounds like Washington talk from what we can see here. He has stated several times this afternoon, since I've been here, that he's on his way back in at any moment to Honduras.
All right. Tim Russo, Free Speech Radio News, reporting for us here on Flashpoints, doing marvelous work, hooking us up with the president of Honduras. That's the duly constituted Democratic president of Honduras at the border with his country. He went in earlier today, as you heard from Tim. The lieutenant colonel who let him in has been, I guess, removed and arrested. And we also, Tim, before we let you go, what about the fact that the president's wife, the first lady, was prevented from joining him at the border? What do we know about that?
Yes, Xiomara Castro de Zelaya, President Manuel Zelaya's wife, was on her way towards the border, and about 40 or about 50 kilometers from the border, just shy of a town called Banlí, which is about 20 minutes shy of where we were earlier this evening time, stopped also by the military. She was stopped with a caravan of about 100 people. There was also other people that were trying to make their way towards the border from Tegucigalpa that were tremendously harassed by the military and the police, and then finally stopped at the same point where she was stopped. Now, you know, there was curfew that was set up as of 12 p.m., 12 12 p.m. midday. It was announced at 11 o'clock. It was imposed at 12. No one's respected it for the most part. The demonstrators and people, Zelaya supporters, have been trying to get to the border regardless of that. But that one point before Dan Lee is where Xiomara Castro got held up. We never had communication directly with her, but we did have communication with Telesur teams that were covering her presence there. They have stopped all press even from moving back and forth across that particular military checkpoint. And last we heard, there was around 300 people at that particular point camped out and trying to decide what they would be doing at that point. I believe they've stayed there and are going to try and hold it out and make their way to Dan Lee or to El Paraíso, where the majority of people were able to arrive. About 3,000, 4,000 people were at the military point where we were earlier today when we did a report just a moment after the tear gas repression of the demonstration at that point. Those people continue to be there. We took a back road and then went through several military roadblocks in order to get here to the border. The last one, particularly difficult, one of the drivers for the vehicles that we were in with the media was held behind in a car, held behind because he didn't have international press credentials. Another Venezuelan journalist was harassed at that particular checkpoint as well. And finally let go because we were just too many journalists there, and so they let him come through as well. But they've really stepped up the military and police control. The police even said they're going to be upping that control and batten down the hatches quite a bit more over the next couple of days. Those are the orders they have. If they're going to begin to restrict press a little bit more. We're going to have to see how that defines itself over the next few days, even this evening time when the journalists try to get back from the border to El Paraíso or to Dan Lee, possibly even to Tegucigalpa, under the curfew. Again, here at the border, we have a pretty marvelous scene. Just moments ago, about 50 people were spotted walking down out of the mountainside. This is a very sort of canopy, light rainforest area. It's very humid here. It rained earlier today. It's very mountainous. And on the outskirts, we heard a few shouts and Urgemel, Urgemel, Vivemel, which is it's urgent to have Mel back. It's urgent to have Mel back. Long live Mel. And we looked up, and there was about 50 people coming down out of the mountainside that had walked about 8 hours through the mountains from their homes and from the roads in order to avoid the military roadblocks to greet President Manuel Zelaya and to accompany him from here on out, depending upon his plans.
So all right.
Team here on the border.
Beautiful. Tim Russo doing spectacular reporting right where you should be, on the front line of a rebellion, an attempt really by the people of Honduras to greet their president and welcome him back to power, the duly constituted president, the one that was voted in through democratic principles in a country that the United States government has attempted to subvert for decades and longer. Tim Russo, be careful. Keep us posted. We want to stay right on top of the story. Thank you.
Okay, Dennis. Take care.
All right. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine in the afternoon. Delighted to be able to provide such a platform for that.
Hello. My name is Bill Means, and I represent the American Indian Movement as well as the International Indian Treaty Council. And right now I'm calling in from South Dakota, my home reservation out here on the Pine Ridge Reservation. We just finished a very powerful ceremony that's very relevant to this issue because it's called the Sundance, one of the seven sacred ceremonies of our Lakota people. And as well, in talking about our brother and friend Leonard Peltier, I had the opportunity to Sundance with him in the past, and this year had special significance because a lot of our people, of course, consider Leonard to be one of our brothers, one of our relatives, one of our warriors who, during the times of Wounded Knee, when there was a reign of terror by the FBI and the goon squads on our reservation of Pine Ridge here in South Dakota, Leonard stepped forward to defend our communities, to defend the older people. Especially significant was the Jumping Bull complex, our ranch as it's known back home, where Leonard eventually was confronted by an armed force of FBI men and defended to women and children and ended up doing two life terms in prison back in 1975. So for 35 years, he's been incarcerated. And we hope and we pray that his parole hearing and the subsequent legal proceedings that happen with Peltier bear some form of justice. Because even in my work with the International Indian Treaty Council, we have raised the issue of Leonard being recognized as a political prisoner, of which there was a tremendous international outcry of solidarity. Amnesty International, Bishop Desmond Tutu, you know, Nelson Mandela, these international figures, the Dalai Lama, they have all come out in support of Leonard Peltier to at least, at the very least, get a new trial. But more so, since he spent so much time incarcerated, it's time for him to be set free as he enters the last years of his life due to the sickness, due to the various forms of health problems that he has since he's been incarcerated. So Leonard means a lot to our people back here in South Dakota, and indeed to indigenous people around the world, and indeed to those people seeking justice, those people who work on behalf of political prisoners, and especially his family, which is more important, that he has now even grandchildren, great-grandchildren that he hasn't even been able to meet. So I think just out of form of some form of reconciliation, some form of human, you might say, justice, I think even time served to say, hey, how long do you have to do in prison before you pay for something that you have never been really proved that you committed this particular crime? So I think, you know, with the various issues of the evidence that happened in the trial that were, you know, consistently brought before the U.S. Supreme Court, other issues such as the withholding of evidence by the United States Justice Department, ruling his case as some form of top secret, therefore they didn't have to hand over various documents to court that could have easily convinced the jury that Leonard Peltier was innocent and that it was in fact United States government that was guilty of a wrongful attack on civilians.
We're speaking with Bill Means. He's a leader in the American Indian Movement. We're talking about the first parole hearing for political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who has served over 33 years, more than, I guess he served almost 8 or 9 years more than Nelson Mandela served as a political prisoner. And Bill Means, you know, we were together for the Republican Convention. We saw what life looks like on this side of the Patriot Act. The FBI, others have tried to suggest that this Leonard Peltier needs to stay in jail because he's a terrorist in the age of terrorism. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think before we've had the war on drugs, and of course, I think the amount of drugs coming into the country has steadily increased over the years. We've had other struggles going back to the civil rights movement, but now all of a sudden we're on this war on terrorism, which they say the person most responsible, Bin Laden, is still at large. And so in the process, everybody else is being attacked on their civil liberties. I think there's very little left of the First Amendment, as you and I witnessed in a Republican convention in the Twin Cities this past year. And not only that, I've talked to a lot of businessmen in the St. Paul downtown area who are very shocked and dismayed as to what happened during the convention, that there was so much police presence, National Guard, Highway Patrol, various types of jurisdictions from four or five states around, including federal jurisdictions, that they basically occupied the city of St. Paul, built up these huge barriers that you saw, that basically made it kind of like a sale barn in cattle country, where you just tell the cows where to go down these alleys, all around for two blocks in front of the convention center. So therefore, the businessmen, who were promised all kinds of economic benefits from bringing a Republican convention, actually lost money. The only people that made money were the law enforcement departments of St. Paul and Minneapolis. So now I believe the Republicans are going to have a very hard time in the future of finding anybody that wants to host a convention that looks like an armed fortress, which we got in the Bush era. So this whole war on terrorism, I think, is highly out of control, especially in the attack on individual rights. There's still young men and women who are being tried with major crimes, including terrorism, under these new terrorism acts, both state and federal, who, just because they want to stand up for free speech, are basically being labeled as terrorists by the Department of Homeland Security and U.S. Justice Department for only doing what everybody did in the 60s to stop a war in Vietnam.
Maybe we can conclude by you just talking a little bit about your relationship with Leonard Peltier, maybe when the last time you spoke with him, giving us a sense of how you think he's doing at this point, and we'll look forward to hearing more through the week.
Well, Leonard, of course, I knew him since before Wounded Knee, and he and I worked on different projects together, including during the time of Wounded Knee, securing support, both financial, political, legal, for the over 500 defendants that were charged in Wounded Knee. As well, I saw him at various AIM actions after Wounded Knee, in which we were fighting against racism, fighting for treaty rights. And since his conviction, he has even devoted more time to reading, to study, to also his artwork. I've seen him transform into a very, very talented artist. He's continued to organize through his committee various chapters all over the world. At one time, I believe in Russia, for example, his support group produced 17 million signatures for a new trial and for his release. So the way I know Leonard, as he become a symbol as how the American government has treated the Indian people, a symbol of the injustice that America has done to Indian people and indeed Western civilization to indigenous peoples all over the world.
All right, Bill Means of the American Indian Movement, a founder with the International Treaty Council as well, working globally for indigenous rights and a global figure in this fight. Bill Means, we're going to watch this story very closely, and we are hoping that the next time we talk about Leonard Peltier and to you, that we can talk to you both together in the same room.
That would surely be an honor, and I pray for his release, as we did recently for all of you as well at our annual Sundance. So thank you very much there, Dennis.
All right. Thank you so much. Be careful.
All right.
Well, let's start with the visit. How is he doing? Tell us a little bit about his health and his spirit.
Well, Leonard is going to be turning 65 in September of this year. And he's got a number of ailments that he's had for many years. He's got a deformity of his jaw that affects him successfully eating and chewing his food. He's got high blood pressure. He's got diabetes. He's got some urinary problems. he's suffering in many ways from ailments that older people tend to suffer from and that are aggravated by virtue of the fact that he's in prison where he doesn't get very consistent or aggressive medical care. But notwithstanding that, Leonard is in generally good spirits. He has never really been destroyed by prison, as many people are. He's continued consistently to not only maintain his innocence, but to maintain his dignity under circumstances that are extremely trying for anybody. He has become a world-acclaimed artist. His artworks have been displayed and have sold all over the world and have raised money for a variety of causes. He is still looked upon as a leader and now more of an elder by many people in Native American communities. And there are many, many people who respect him not only for what he did, but for what he has done in all the years that he's been in prison. He's never cried or complained. He's maintained that a serious injustice was done, that he and his colleagues at the time were fighting for something that was well worth fighting for. And so he's maintained his dignity, his self-respect, and therefore his mental state is really somewhat remarkable. And we're hopeful that he'll be able to convey that to the parole commission tomorrow.
I was noting that he has now served, I guess, about 8 years longer than Nelson Mandela in South Africa. And thus, you say, you know, to maintain your dignity and your calm for so long through so much is rather extraordinary. And as you are confirming, I guess he still maintains that he is innocent of these charges and that he was a victim. This is a political attack.
He is going to tell the parole commission tomorrow, partly what they're waiting to hear, is that he was there at the time that this shootout occurred, that he participated in the shootout. He fired a weapon at the two agents who were ultimately killed from a distance, along with several other Native Americans who were encamped on the reservation at that time. He will acknowledge all that, and he will acknowledge that he's saddened and regrets the deaths that occurred that day, not only of the two agents, but of one of the Native Americans, a young man by the name of Joseph Stuntz. So he will tell them all of that, but he will also tell them that he fired in self-defense, that the two of his co-defendants who were tried and on charges of of shooting from a distance were acquitted because of self-defense, that he maintains that they had no choice under those circumstances but to return the fire that was coming from the two agents, and that he never intended to kill anybody. He just intended to defend himself and those who were encamped there. So all of that is going to be aired tomorrow at length. Up to now, there have only been short parole hearings, which have focused more on Leonard's eligibility for even the consideration for parole. Those questions are now resolved. He's clearly eligible for parole for the first time. So we now can turn to the reasons why he should be paroled, and hopefully that's what the focus of tomorrow's hearing will be.
Now, for those who are not that familiar with the case, just take a few seconds to briefly talk about what appeared to be a legal circus being conducted by the FBI in terms of the way in which this trial was carried out, witnesses were presented or not presented. There were serious problems, correct?
There were outrageous problems, and anybody looking back on the timeline of what took place would be, even to this day, appalled that some of those things were allowed to occur at the time and that the courts have not disturbed them in the many years since then. Initially, what happened was that there was a shootout in which, according to the government's estimates, about 20 Native Americans fired at the two agents who were firing at them. Three people died, as I said earlier. All of the Native Americans escaped from the area, and that triggered a massive manhunt on behalf of the FBI to try to find and bring to justice the people whom they felt were responsible for the deaths of their two young agents. We've gotten all of the documents over time. Well, I shouldn't say all. We've gotten thousands of pages of documents which demonstrate the way in which the FBI conducted that investigation leading up to the ultimate indictment of four people. Two of those people went to trial in a case that was conducted in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, because of the prejudices that were obvious in North and South Dakota, where the events themselves occurred. And as a consequence of that trial, those two individuals were acquitted. Leonard had fled to Canada, and the fourth defendant had his charges dropped against him because he wasn't involved. After the two were acquitted in the Cedar Rapids trial, we see from the documents that the FBI begrudgingly has surrendered that they decided that somebody had to be held accountable, and the only person they had left who they could tie to the incident and to the shooting was Leonard Peltier. So in order to avoid a replay of what happened in Cedar Rapids, they decided that they would go about Leonard's trial somewhat differently. First of all, they decided they would try him as the person who, after the shootout had died down and the two agents were wounded, actually went up to where the agents were and fired the fatal shots that caused their deaths. There were no eyewitnesses to that, but there was a piece of ballistics evidence that they thought that they could tie to Leonard's gun. So if they could show that Leonard actually fired the fatal shots, the theory of the prosecution was that there was no self-defense issue involved and they would not have to replay what took place in the earlier trial. In order to get Leonard back, however, from Canada, they had to do more than that. So they persuaded, and I put that word in parentheses, a young woman who was mentally ill, and that's not really in dispute, by the name of Myrtle Poorbear, to sign a series of three affidavits, each one is more contradictory than the other, in which she claims to have been there and seen Leonard shoot the two agents. She wasn't there at all, and it was all just fabrication. But those affidavits were prepared by the FBI. They were taken to Canada, where they were used to convince the Canadian authorities to extradite Leonard back to the United States. When Leonard got back to the United States, his trial was moved from Iowa, which was a relatively neutral environment, back to North Dakota before a judge who was notoriously biased against Indian activists. And the trial then unfolded in an atmosphere in which the FBI did everything to convince the jury that the AIM activists were all terrorists and were coming there to endanger the lives of the jurors as well as their families. In that environment, the government persuaded the jury through the use of ballistics evidence that Leonard had fired the fatal shots, and therefore he was found guilty very quickly by a jury that deliberated for a relatively short period of time. After the trial, it turned out the ballistics evidence was not accurate, that ballistics evidence had been withheld from the defense that would have helped to contradict what was shown on the witness stand. And the Court of Appeals, nevertheless, although they criticized the government for withholding evidence that should have been provided and would have helped the defense and might have resulted in a different outcome, the Court of Appeals nevertheless sustained the verdict on the grounds that since Leonard was there and he shot at the agents from a distance, he was guilty nevertheless. Of course, that was the same theory on which the other two people had been acquitted. But in the manner in which Leonard's case was tried, he could not avail himself of that same powerful defense because of the defective ballistics evidence. After the trial also, there turned out to be substantial evidence that there were contradictions about the vehicles involved, the positioning of the vehicles, who actually shot from various locations. There turned out to be a whole series of contradictions which were demonstrated in a film that Robert Redford made, which contradicted most of the evidence on which the prosecution relied at Leonard's trial. And yet Leonard still has served now 33 years in prison for something that very few people who are familiar with the records and transcripts and the proceedings think was a fair and just outcome.
All right. Finally, I'll just let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Eric Seitz. He is the appeals attorney for Leonard Peltier. Tomorrow in Pennsylvania, Leonard Peltier will be given his first parole hearing in 16 years. He is ill, but as we hear, in very good spirits. Does he have a chance, particularly in the context of post-9/11, really pumping up the terrorism fears and all that surrounds that? Does that make your work and more difficult? and diminish Leonard Peltier's chances?
I don't think so. I think the environment here is one in which people have reassessed a lot of what happened back in the 60s and 70s when the so-called terrorists of that period were hunted down, and many of them were killed by government agents, and many of them were prosecuted and framed and thrown in prisons for a long time. Leonard comes from a generation of activists who have very, very clearly now by history been vindicated, and he's one of the last. And so I think that there are a lot of people who are very sympathetic, and even if they think that he was guilty of something for which he should have gone to prison, are of the opinion that he served more than enough time, and enough is enough, and he should now be released. So we think we're operating in an environment that is more favorable than it's ever been, notwithstanding the events of 9/11 and the aftermath. And we think there are lots of people who have supported Leonard and who are sympathetic, who are out there, who are continuing to generate good public opinion and support for him to be paroled.
Are you hearing that support? What is most impressive to you about that?
We are hearing it. And more importantly, Leonard is hearing it from prison staff and other people who have come up to him repeatedly in the last week or so and have wished him good luck and have done so somewhat publicly, where they know that their actions are being watched by other officials inside the system. So we have a sense that there's a lot of support there, and that maybe this is the right time for Leonard, and we're extremely hopeful that that the parole commission will do the right thing.
Well, I hope you will give your client our best wishes. We hope that you're successful tomorrow, and maybe next time we speak, we can all be in the same room talking about this.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Good luck to you now.
Thanks.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now go back to the situation on the ground in occupied Palestine. The Obama administration's Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Middle East envoy George Mitchell were both in the region over the past several days, wrapping up talks with state leaders. U.S. National Security Advisor James Jones arrived in Jerusalem yesterday. Mitchell remarked to the foreign press that he had made, quote, good progress in talks with Israeli officials, but did not mention any outcome of the reason for the talks, which were to reach agreements on Israel's illegal settlement expansion and construction projects in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, while these talks were in progress, extreme right-wing Israeli settler groups built 11 new so-called outposts in and around the West Bank, a plan that was timed to coincide with the U.S. officials' visits in a protest of defiance of international law and settlement negotiations. Robert Gates, for his part, stressed the U.S.'s interest in placing sanctions against Iran for its alleged nuclear program, but perhaps forgot to mention Israel's secret nuclear weapons program as he defended U.S. President Barack Obama's intentions to, quote, continue to provide a robust annual military assistance package to Israel. He added, quote, we are contributing both financial and technical assistance to strengthen Israel's defense against the growing threat posed by rockets and missiles, and we will continue to ensure that Israel has the most advanced weapons for its national defense. Elsewhere in occupied Palestine, several Israeli tanks and bulldozers invaded Al-Qarara town on the southern border of the Gaza Strip, according to reports from the International Middle East Media Center. IMEMC says that bulldozers destroyed farmlands as tanks opened fire at nearby homes. And Hamas officials announced that they will allow several hundred Fatah leaders living in Gaza to travel to the West Bank to attend the movement's sixth Congress next week, after Fatah promised to release 200 Hamas members from Palestinian Authority prisons in the West Bank. Joining us to talk about the current situation inside occupied Palestine at this point is our special correspondent, John Elmer. John is a freelance reporter and photojournalist. He writes for Interpress Service and is now based in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. John, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
So last we talked, you were at the border near Gaza hoping to enter. After a couple of weeks of waiting, you were essentially denied entry and are now back in the West Bank. So let's talk about what's happening there. We've got the U.S. trifecta meeting in Jerusalem in the region, Robert Gates, George Mitchell, and James Jones. And there seems to be another stalemate in terms of real comprehensive so-called settlement negotiations. John, do you think Israel will be persuaded here to stop the settlement projects? You know, the wordings in these negotiations is very vague and lightweight. They're talking about stopping settlement expansion, but not much, if anything, is being said about the fact that these settlements themselves are illegal colonies in the first place, And under international law, every single one must be dismantled. What's going on here? Can you explain these diplomatic nuances?
Well, it's important to understand for people who haven't seen the what are called, in the as a euphemism, the facts on the ground. But what we're talking about as settlements are actually either small cities or full-size cities. There's more than 300,000 Israeli settlers that live in the major settlement blocks, as they're called, in the West Bank, and 200,000 more in East Jerusalem. And the goal, the express goal from the settler movement themselves, is to, as one settler leader told me a number of years back, it's like Lego blocks. They build these settlements, Jewish concentrated areas within Palestinian areas, and then over the years, through expropriation of various means, they connect these individual settlements into settlement blocks, which become cities. If you were to be in Israel proper and drive into one of these settlements, you would never notice that you entered the West Bank. The wall apparatus has made that even more clear. The wall is not a border, but it's a wall around Palestinian areas. It doesn't separate. It's not a border as such, but rather the creation of ghettos around the Palestinian population. And so these settlements are and have always been strictly, you know, and the founder of them, Ariel Sharon, you know, strictly called them geopolitical formations, the idea being that you bring in military installations at first and then civilianize them. And the idea was that, you know, the world understood, and Sharon and the Israeli planners themselves understood that military bases amid Palestinian in the occupied West Bank would be seen as illegitimate, but the civilianization, the moving of civilian presence into those areas, would make them facts on the ground and make them difficult to remove. Well, now 40 years on from the settlement project, we see the reality of that, and that is that these settlements, it's not like Gush Katif, these settlements in Gaza that were uprooted, you know, with 5,000 settlers in them. These are major cities with city infrastructure, universities, you know, that whole apparatus of a state exists within these settlements. They're not isolated. They're not on the frontiers. But they're integrated right into Israeli society itself, you know, through its rail, through its roads, through its water and power system. And they're not really, as I say, distinguishable from Israel itself. And so the concept that these settlements need to be slowed or stopped, or the growth, is kind of a throwback to the 1990s when, you know, the settlement growth under the Oslo process fully doubled. You know, after the peace agreements fully doubled. And so they, really Israel has used the peace process to literally cement these settlement infrastructures within the state. And it's difficult for any observer to see how those settlements are going to be uprooted. And the way that they're situated is all on major roads. They're major fingers into the West Bank, which cut off the major population centers for the Palestinians. And make it so that, you know, a trip of 20 kilometers takes an hour and a half. And the idea was always, as it was in Gaza on a minor scale, it is in the West Bank, and Sharon calls them the fingers. And the idea is to stick these fingers in to cut up Palestinian continuity within the West Bank, make an independent Palestinian state, any kind of viable independent Palestinian state, impossible. Make it either a situation where it's so intolerable to live inside the ghettos that Palestinians leave the country, or, you know, worst case scenario in the Israeli plan is to create a Bantustan, a ghetto, a reservation, you know, what the Israelis call a canton. These are just different names for the same process of separating the indigenous population from the settler population, and the settlements are the vanguard of that. And so, as you said in your lead, in Ariel, the largest settlement that protrudes through the middle of the West Bank, on the fringes of Ariel is where you have settlers on horseback with Uzis, going with flamethrowers and burning down olive trees on the peripheries, on Palestinian land on the peripheries, making it so that Palestinians cannot access their land on fear of death. then that land can be slowly expropriated and swallowed into this major apparatus that is the city of Ariel. And so step by step, stone by stone, quite literally, as Sharon famously said, stone by stone, they settle the greater Israel. And in lieu of a peace agreement, the longer Israel can delay the peace process, every single day the cranes are digging, the cement is being poured, and the infrastructure is being developed to bring these settlements into Israel proper. And so we're now in 2009, and every year a trifecta, as you called it, of American envoys come to the region and talk about settlement growth. Well, all the while, the apartheid apparatus is further entrenched and, as I said, literally cemented. And it's really hard. You know, people talk about, often ask reporters like us when we're over here, well, what do you see as the solution? And it's very difficult to envision a solution where there's two states living side by side, viably in peace, because these settlements expressly make that impossible. And that's the goal.
That's the voice of our special correspondent, John Elmer, speaking to us from the occupied West Bank. And John, Mustafa Barghouti of the Palestinian Mubadara, the National Initiative Party, told Al Jazeera that, quote, the credibility of the whole U.S. diplomatic effort hinged on whether Israel could be persuaded to stop settlement activity. What about how Palestinians on the street in Bethlehem, in Ramallah, in Hebron, are saying about the U.S.'s credibility right now in terms of the settlement negotiations?
I mean, to be honest, the settlement issue is so far gone for Palestinians on the street because, while we talk about it in abstract terms, the cities, in Bethlehem here, literally my desk overlooks Har Homa settlement here, and the lights from the settlement illuminate the whole valley. And so these physical, the physical apparatus is just so clear. The wall, the way that people live their daily life is impacted so fundamentally by this apparatus that the idea that the defense secretary is going to come here and stop the settlement growth or that the settlements are the primary focus of what's going on is, I think, a bit, like I said, it's a bit 20 years ago's narrative. And it's a bit far gone because the reality is that on the ground, every single day in these areas and that, you don't hear on the news at all, save for programs like yours, that every day there's arrest raids going on in the refugee camps. Political activists are being rounded up by both the Israelis and the new collaborationist security force that Robert Gates is so instrumental in putting on the ground, just as he was in putting them on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq. The Palestinian collaborationist security forces are crucial to this project, and that's what Palestinians see day in and day out. And the settlement apparatus where, 10 years ago, literally 10 years ago, a settlement as massive as Har Homa didn't exist. It was a forested hilltop. And today, during the just during the Intifada, the cementing of that settlement is such that it's the permanency of it is clear for everybody to see, and I think that's a lot what the Israeli planners themselves talk about when they say we're running out of time. Ehud Olmert, Tzipi Livni, talking about running out of time on the two-state solution because Palestinians see the infrastructure, they see the failure of the peace process, and they say that this two-state solution, although that's the popular, they want the national movement wants its own homeland, but they don't want a series of fragmented ghettos. And so in place of that, the vision sort of moves either to ignore it. There is a strong sense, it's important to note, a strong sense of numbness, if you will, on the Palestinian street, if we can call it that. After the brutality of the Intifada gave way to the failures of the disengagement, which gave way to the fraudulent undermined election, sanctions, blockade, and then the subsequent coup, where an unelected government has taken control of the apparatus of state, if we can call it that. It's not, but the Palestinian Authority was taken over by the party that was expressly ousted by the democratic will of the people. I think that's created a real numbness on the ground. And in the years past when I've been here, even though they knew it was a failure, the shuttle diplomacy visits by the trifectas were on in every coffee shop, were on in every store in the background. And, you know, to be honest, here in Bethlehem, I haven't seen it, haven't heard it discussed on the street beyond, just beyond in passing. And so I think while it's major news over there, it's not so much here.
Well, John, let's talk about this Western support for the Palestinian Authority that you alluded to. We've focused on this story many times, but it's always good to get a real-time update. The United States has installed a so-called counterterrorism specialist, Lieutenant Keith Dayton, who's been contracted another 2 years to work in the West Bank and train Palestinian Authority security forces against Hamas in a move that many are likening to an Iran-Contra redux. If you could update us on the situation here and talk about the significance in terms of the timing as Israel and the United States continue to ally with PA officials and what effect this is having on the ground in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip for the Palestinians who are dealing with the PA as subcontractors of the Israeli occupation.
Well, Robert Gates toured the country in 2007, 2008, giving speeches at every major military academy. Anytime anyone would listen, giving speeches about the importance of the new shift in the war on terror, what they call now the long war. And Gates was talking about the importance of not simply the fighting, the sharp end of the stick that we see in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the more counterinsurgency type warfare. That is acknowledging that these insurgencies, these uprisings, are fundamentally political in nature and therefore have to be fought comprehensively. And the Palestinian arena gets drawn into that long war, of course. And one of Gates' quotes, if I could read it here, he says, and this is what he said at the U.S. Naval Academy, he said, "Arguably the most important military component in the war on terror is not the fighting we do ourselves, but how well we enable and empower our partners to defend and govern themselves. Standing up and mentoring of indigenous armies and police, once the province of special forces, is now a key mission for the military as a whole." And so when you mentioned Contras, this apparatus was something that would be very well known to followers of Latin American politics in the 70s and 80s, where CIA and American special forces covertly, clandestinely organized these security forces. Well, today it's out in the open. And Keith Dayton's a perfect example of that, because any time you get a microphone near him, he'll explain to you how important this project of training these PA security forces is. And it fits right within this counterinsurgency mold. And although the training of the PA, the collaborationists, the work with Israel hand-in-hand security forces, of course, dates back to the 1990s. It dates back to the years following the first Palestinian, what's called the first Palestinian Intifada, but it's probably actually the fifth Palestinian Intifada, but what's known as the first Intifada, 87 to 92, which precipitated the Oslo peace process. The idea was to bring those fighters, bring them into the national project by creating a collaborationist force to subcontract the Israeli occupation.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.